The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Medievalist. Today we're going to be dealing with something that I've actually been putting off for a while. It is part and parcel of a nationalist theory of education. And in this particular case, we're going to be dealing with Penteleimon Kulish, who is a a late 19th century Ukrainian nationalist and agrarian writer, and is considered one of the great progenitors of a Ukrainian agrarian idea, particularly in education. Now, Ukraine had been deprived of any real serious kind of educational establishment after the abolition of the office of Hetman under Catherine II. The Hetman, or the leader of the Cossacks, represented Ukrainian independence, represented, as Hrushevsky would say, the coming of age of Ukrainian nationalism, and the mentality of the population actually becoming political, the population being involved in political and social life as an ethnic entity. The church was always under attack from Polish landlords and from many others throughout Ukraine. But the church was able to give every what little education there was. And of course, in church schools, there was no money taken, there were no fees taken, and so even under relatively oppressive conditions, you had Ukraine by the beginning of the 19th century being one of the more literate parts of the Russian Empire. But still, after Catherine II, one of the evil figures in Ukrainian history, in repressing the ruling class of the Ukrainian Cossacks and bringing them into Russian orbit by granting them fiefs, by granting them serfs, and thereby separating the Cossack upper classes from the masses of the population. The church was able to fill the gap to some extent, although relying really on very meager resources. But there was another institution that's very specific to Ukraine, and that's the Hromada, or the Brotherhood, the community, where the Orthodox world had been divided, really because many of the bishops were very unsure of themselves, not too positive as to where to turn, and especially in dealing with the relatively anti-Orthodox rule of Catherine the Great. Lay associations of Ukrainian Orthodox people came into existence, and they were located throughout the countryside, and some of these brotherhood schools then took up some of the slack in terms of education. So by the rise of the nationalist movement in the middle of the 19th century, people like Penteleimon Kulish began wondering substantially about the nature of education and how young Ukrainian people were to be educated. And his views are very complex, and they deserve to be taken seriously for his time as well as for our own time, and exactly how young people are to be educated under oppressive conditions. Kulish begins his investigation really by taking Rousseau as his central figure. The point is that he did believe that human nature, especially the Ukrainian farmer and the agrarian life in general, and this is going to be central not only to Kulish but to Ukrainian nationalism in general, that the agrarian life is central not just to the national idea but also to moral development. So I'm not so sure that Coolidge took entirely to heart the idea that human nature is naturally good, but at the very least, those who live close to the land, small landholders, small farmers, thrifty yeomen, which you actually had in Ukraine, you also had in the far north of Russia, you had it in Siberia, you didn't have the yeomen in central Russia, but that this yeoman mentality was a good one. And because it was close to nature, it was close to the land, it meant that human nature is good, at least in that context. Penteleimon Kulish, like a lot of Ukrainian writers, and I'm thinking of people like Skovoroda and others, held that not so much the head to be at the center, but the heart to be at the center. The heart is that synthesis of the mind and its logical movement, its logical design, its scientific approach to things, but that doesn't exist by itself. Kulish's point of view, and you see this within the Ukrainian nationalist movement quite often, that the heart is where the logical designs of the mind are synthesized, are integrated with the life of the people, the life of the folk, the songs, the culture, the church services. Everything is brought together into an integrated unity. Logic is not rejected, but logic is integrated with a very rich cultural life. Logic doesn't exist on its own. Logic never exists in isolation. Logic comes into existence because literate people attempt to make sense out of their cultural environment. So the logical mind is necessary. The cultural mind is necessary. They come together in the heart. But because Kulish is an agrarian, and the agrarian world is central to his view, not just of education, but of everything political, there is this idea of the encroachment of civilization becoming a massive problem, not just in Kulish's theory, but in Ukrainian life. Kulish agrees with people like Dostoevsky and the agrarian movement in general, including people like Tolstoy, that civilization is inherently divisive. We're talking really industrial, urban, capitalist civilization here, so the bourgeois values here. That these are repressive, that these are divisive, that these are arbitrarily hierarchical, and that they seem to reward not virtue, not the hardest worker, not the most intelligent, not the most interesting, but those who are able to manipulate money, who are able to manipulate the society. Everything about that kind of urban, industrial, or even quasi-industrial civilization is wrong and problematic. And there is an area where he agrees fully with Tolstoy. And this is one of his central concerns. A real Ukrainian yeoman is, by definition, a rural figure who looks with a great degree of hostility to the urban world. The urban world, the civilized world, so to speak, is a world of manipulation, is a world of falsehood, is a world of sin. It's the world, most of all, of arbitrary hierarchy. So, for Kulish, the idea of an education is to show the young man, show the young boy in rural society the emotional and romantic connection to the landscape. You see in Ukrainian poetry a great stress on what is very specific about the Ukrainian world, about the steppe, the plains. This tremendous feeling of grandeur, whether you're in central Nebraska or whether you are in Ukraine, there is something overpowering about the plains, about the overwhelming power of the horizon. And this is something that Kulish, he wants to show that people aren't going to care about their people, about the culture around them, about fighting the urban capitalist culture the merchant culture, unless they're provided with strong, emotional, heartfelt ties to the land, to the people, to the landscape, and to the architecture. Educational is first and foremost emotional, but when I say emotional, I think the central idea, I think, is romantic. That romance, that love, that devotion comes first, and then you can let education take its course. And then, within that mentality, we have really the idea that the family, not the school as an institution, should be the center of the educational world. Now, this means a few things. This means that education should be local. It should be parochial. And in saying that, I mean it should concern the values and the needs of the local community. There is no such thing as some sort of abstract universal education. Education needs to be tailored to the needs of the people. You can only do that if you push elites out of the way. You know, globalism, as we know it, is the creation of the multinational corporation and of the states that they control, and the academics and university professors that they control. And they've created these pseudosciences of this globalized, acultural, a-ethnic universe, which does nothing but serve their interests. If the family, if the locality, if the land is to be taken seriously, then you have to say that education has to follow its contours and not the other way around. Kulish was an admirer of all, as all Ukrainian nationalists are, of Shevchenko, and we've dealt with him on this program before. Shevchenko represents to Kulish somebody who didn't accept an idea, whether it be poetic, whether it be political, whether it be economic, that didn't come from the Ukrainian peasantry, that didn't come from the workers of the land, that didn't come from the working class. And one of the great things about small state nationalism, and it's something that kind of brought me to Ukraine, where my religious affiliations are, and Ireland, where my ethnic affiliations are, that you always have this strong connection between a legitimate agrarian decentralized socialism on the one hand and the ethnic group and the national idea on the other. Bringing this together, you're talking about a social nationalist idea, and you see it all throughout Ukraine, you see it in Serbia, you see it in Ireland. It's something that goes along with the mentality of a small state with a history of repression in one form or another from larger states, that is struggling to maintain a very precarious kind of independence, whether it be cultural or political, against what seems to be overwhelming odds from the outside. But for Kulish, he understood the city to be something inherently foreign to the Ukrainian idea. And there again, you see it in Ireland. Cities did not develop in Ireland until the Vikings, and even they were simply trading posts, military barracks, really, and nothing else. So really, in all seriousness, you could make the argument that urban life didn't develop in Ireland until the Normans, until the 12th and 13th century. And I think it's something close to the Ukrainian mind, and as I go along, it's more and more evident how close Ukraine and Ireland are in terms of their ethnic experience and how they see themselves in the world. And that these two peoples, I think, are often ignored peoples, culturally speaking, philosophically speaking, even politically speaking, and yet it's very clear that they have a cultural influence far out of proportion to their size. And that's something that should be thought about long and hard. But just like in Ireland, Kulish holds the idea that urbanism is something foreign, it's something imported, and the fact is that mid-late 19th century Ukraine, urban life was Jewish and Russian. And so Kulish holds the idea that really the urban world is a sinful, foreign, Judaic society that functions by exploiting the countryside and exploiting each other as much as possible. As an antidote to that, Coolidge holds the view that schools should be under the control of the village, of the extended family, and should be under its elected headship. Remember, all throughout the Slavic world, you have the centrality of the village that no matter what the actual political society happens to be, village society is elected and strictly democratic, but on a religious, localist, and nationalist basis. You know, Coolidge holds that the religion of the Ukrainian people should be one of a great level of simplicity. He doesn't quite reject the Orthodox world. He doesn't quite reach the radicalism of Tolstoy. All Ukrainian nationalists, even Ivan Franko, hold the Orthodox Church in veneration, but might not necessarily follow all of its dictates. And obviously this is something that I personally am going to disagree with. But I can respect the idea that an Orthodoxy needs to be close to the people and close to the land. This conciliarism, this idea of local control in Ukrainian is called sabonopravanya, or the right, the justice of the synod, of these nested councils, or soborni, representing the life of the common population of the agrarian village, and that it and it alone should have full control over the church, over the clergy, over its finances and land, and also over education. The concept of sabonopravan, I've written on this extensively. It's one of the central ideas in my political makeup. It's something that is specifically a part of the Ukrainian Orthodox society. You see it among the Russian Old Believers. You see it in the monastic life in northern Russia and Siberia. You see it in some of the more out of the way parts of Mount Athos in Greece. This idea of local conciliar control, never, of course, separating itself from the tradition and doctrine of the church, but understanding that that the control over church properties, over its functioning, over its cultural context, over the clergy, and its social manifestation exists as a result of the council, of the local council, and this is very important. The grace of the Trinity is not given in this top-down fashion from the bishops down to the people. If anything, it's the other way around. That grace is something that exists in the community, and bishops are elected by these groups of councils out of that subordinate mentality. Bishops depend on the people, not the people on the bishops. And this is something that the Ukrainian church in particular has stressed to a great extent. It is a form of Orthodox congregationalism, and the Ukrainians have made it absolutely central. And Coolidge, you know, held the view that you read the New Testament, and one thing you see about Jesus Christ is that he is very opposed to the arbitrary rule of nobles. Christ was a man of tremendous abilities, even from a strictly secular point of view. He was a man without a home. He was a man without a reputation, did not come from wealth, did not come from power, and he associated overwhelmingly with the common lot of the ignorant sinner, you and I. And that's the religion of Ukrainian nationalism. That's the Ukrainian of the religion of the Ukrainian agrarian life. That it's the common folk who are the backbone of the church, and that is always going to be the case. Nobles and kings and popes, they can do positive things for the church. They could finance the church and everything else, but they do as much harm as they do good. Liberty, you know, and Coolidge's approach to all of these things, you know, he's basically acting as an apolitical writer. He's saying that the political organization of the state, whether it be a monarchy or an oligarchy or a democracy, a republic, a theocracy, whatever view the state has adopted, does not affect the real communal liberty of the village, of the sobor. Any government, no matter what it's based on, can function and respect the autonomy of the village. Democracy could do this, a monarchy could do this. Any form of government can then repress the village and its autonomy and its sobor. A democracy can do that, an oligarchy could do that, a monarchy can do that. So political forms aren't important. You see this quite often. You see this in the Russian Slavophiles. You see this in people like Ivanov. You see it in people like Solzhenitsyn. You see it in Dostoevsky. These people don't go around arguing for a specific form of government. They don't go around saying monarchy is the best, or oligarchy is the best, or democracy is the best. They're talking about virtue. They're talking about what social conditions have to apply in order that the common folk can develop the religious and orthodox virtues that are so necessary and so important to a happy life, and even more important, a happy death. Those kind of things are not so much dependent on political forms. Kulish is going to hold, and generally does hold, that they are dependent on the maintenance of the sobor, of the council, and of the local society, the maintenance of the autonomy of the sobor, of the locality, and of its independence. What is at the center is morality, language, the customs of the people, of the village. All of these things taken as one single integral whole and manifesting what we call the heart. The heart of a society, the heart of a people. Heart not so much in an anatomical sense, but heart in a metaphorical sense, in a metaphysical sense. It's that entity that synthesizes everything. All of our experience, our ethnic, our religious views, the life of the land, the life of the sobor, or the community. The life of science and logic, of literature and poetry, all of this brought together in one single act of apprehension, of one single experience. Urban life is the ultimate destroyer. It isn't the state, it isn't the form of government, but it's the urban life in its Judaic and carnal mentality that is destructive. More than anything else, Kulish says that real solidarity and real subono pravan is by its very constitution anti-capitalist, and it is anti-individualist. The peasants, whether it be in Russia or in Ukraine, show the health and vigor of society. They are the backbone of society, and like in America in 2009, this faction of society has been put on, has been destroyed, has been mocked as hicks and rednecks, has had land stolen, has had land foreclosed on by the state, and all of this, as a Spotlight reported many years ago when I first started there, a deal made in, I believe it was 1999, among the U.S. government, Department of Agriculture, and Archer Daniels Midland and ConAgra, who got together and divided up the country among them. That is to say, divided up the farmland among them, and of course, therefore, did everything in their power to destroy and disenfranchise the small farmer and the family farm. No one cared. No one did a thing, because I think most Americans have been trained to believe that the farmer is an ignorant hick, and the fewer of them, the better. But Kulish would hold that the more their lifestyle is marginalized and attacked, and this was the case among nobles living in cities and Jews, that the Ukrainian farmer was an ignorant hick who knew nothing and who needed to be, it really is only good for exploitation. Education, if anything, is a moral education, and it's a practical education. It's not just an absorption of the culture and of the ethnic group. It's also the formation of trades, and not so much abstract education, but trades and things that are useful for the village, useful for the locality. And really the fraud of American higher education is that you see these kids who come into college. There's so many universities now. There are tens of thousands of American universities. There are so many kids in college. There's such an inflation of professors out there now. You have millions of kids in college that really shouldn't be there. They're not real scholars. They're not out to study poetry. They're not out to study Plato and Aristotle and St. Augustine. They're there majoring in stupid things like business and finance and accounting, as if these things are actually academic subjects that should be in universities. You know, that's for a very specific group of people who love the life of the mind for the sake of the life of the mind. Practical things, non-academic things, trades, these things should be at the local level and dedicated to assisting the community and taking your part in the community life. But something that Coolidge holds as absolutely central is the inner moral sense. You see this in Dostoevsky, you see it in Tolstoy, that the inner moral sense is what matters. Bourgeois society is dedicated to the false exterior, wearing the fashionable clothes, spouting the fashionable cliches, supporting the fashionable political figures, whoever they happen to be. This is the lie of the city, and we would say even the suburbs in America today. The lie of the city, the phony front, and it's the wealthy. You know, and you see this all over the place. In Nikolai Vumilovich, you see it in the Church Fathers, and it's the wealthy who really are the sickest of all. It's the wealthy who are the most depressed. It's the wealthy who are the most alienated. These people who have put their whole life and world into money, knowing full well that they're going to die in a few years. They could die tomorrow, in fact. Coolidge, like so many in the Ukrainian nationalist movement, hold that centralization is the greatest evil. A democracy can centralize, an oligarchy can centralize, a monarchy can centralize. But all three of those could also decentralize. So if he's going to make any political comment at all, it's going to be that it is the it is a centralization of power, economic or otherwise, that is the greatest of evil. Coolidge talks in vicious terms about the city. The sexual revolution, he's actually talking about the sexual revolution, saying the city takes our Ukrainian women and treats them as prostitutes. This is what is disgusting about urban life, and this is something central to Coolidge's idea of education. We're going to shift gears here, and when we come back in a few minutes, we're going to shift to a few other different topics, and I hope you stay with us.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. We've been talking about Pantelimon Coolidge in Ukraine and his ideas on education. I want to shift gears and talk about a different but related topic. Dostoevsky's Winter Notes from 1863, notebooks and aphorisms on social life and the middle classes in Russia. in the 1860s, which really are worth talking about, what kind of a man Dostoevsky is, and his similarities to Penteleimon Kulish in many important areas. And we can learn a lot from these guys, and it's unfortunate that very few people, certainly very few nationalists, really deal with them in anything other than slogans. Dostoevsky and Kulish really reject this weird Western idea of freedom. It comes out of the French Revolution. That somehow means that you have the right to do, some inherent, inarguable right to do whatever you want. And, you know, you see in Dostoevsky really one of the first times in modern life, certainly in modern Russian life, that the mentality of do whatever you want is something that benefits only one group in society, and that is those with money. The powerful living in cities may tell the world that you could do whatever you want, whatever feels good, but of course there can only be one winner, and that's those who have the money and power to make that desire powerful, make it overwhelming, make it even socially obligatory. If you're just, you know, in other words, if you hold to the view that freedom is this anarchic, I could do whatever I want, then you're essentially giving the wealthy a license to dominate you and everybody else. Because they, those with money, can simply say, you do whatever you want, well, I'm doing whatever I want. The fact that I have more money just means that what I want ends up becoming far more powerful than anything that you want. Dostoevsky says that this is the mentality of the cities. This is the mentality of the urban ruling classes, whether it be Jewish or Russian, to some extent German, and you have some German merchants in Russian cities, certainly in Petersburg, of course, right next to Scandinavia. Dostoevsky, like Penteleimon Kulish, hated the bourgeoisie. The French word bourgeoisie, means someone who lives in a city, proving that capitalism, the merchant, vulgar, materialist, carnal mentality, is urban by its very structure. The word bourgeois is somebody who lives within a city, someone who lives within a city for the purpose of dominating it. Dostoevsky looks at these upper middle class types as vulgar. You know, he views them in his Winter Notes of 1863. He views them as having all the power of an aristocrat, but none of the education or polish of an aristocrat. Money exists for money's sake. And this is a problem for aristocracies. You know, I have a problem with aristocracies as they've fought the monarchy as well as the village in their history. I want to make it very clear that aristocracies are anti-royalist by definition. If royal power increases, aristocratic power decreases. If village, communal power increases, aristocratic power decreases. So they exist really in the worst possible world, the world that fights monarchy on the one hand and also fights the village commune on the other. This, unfortunately, is also something that exists in the more westernized parts of the Russian aristocracy. But at least Dostoevsky is going to make the claim that there's at least one good feature of aristocracy. And I agree with him on this. And that is culture. That the culture of old Russia exists primarily in either the monasteries or the aristocratic court. The problem is that the bourgeoisie have the worst of both worlds. On the one hand, they have the power of aristocracy and the oppressive capacity of the aristocracy, but they don't have the redeeming quality of culture. It's a phony culture. It's a faux culture. It's a culture that, it's a pretense to culture. It's kitsch. It's the very opposite of what real culture and art are supposed to be. The one good thing about aristocracy is that they did maintain the cultural inheritance of the people and have been able to travel and see the world and be able to compare this with other peoples. You know, they've been very helpful. And even in Ukraine, you have a great degree of the so-called status school, this idea that the aristocracy can never be eliminated from political considerations because their power has been used to lay the groundwork for a real national revival. So this is, you know, there's a debate there. But Dostoevsky's point is that the bourgeoisie, this middle class and upper middle class of vulgarity, this is the opposite of culture. They have the power, and yet they're vulgar. So they're the worst of all worlds. That they have no polish. Their intelligence exists solely in money. They only care about what is practical or pragmatic. And of course, we all know that that means what's going to get you a profit. Nothing matters unless it could somehow give you a cash payoff somewhere down the road. Dostoevsky holds that this class in Russian society is almost exclusively destructive. They are immoral, but they are also amoral. If you put material goods as your divinity, as God, then you don't have a morality. It's not that you're immoral. It's not that you're bad. It's just that you're worshiping the wrong thing. And he sees this in Russia, but he sees this all over the place, even in so-called democracies. What really pays off is what Dostoevsky calls flunkyism. We know in our American or British experience, we know that what really matters in your job, I've learned this the hard way in academia, in any bureaucracy, what matters is mediocrity. You don't want to be incompetent, but I've found in my experience that an equally bad danger to being incompetent is being too competent. I found out the hard way that being too competent means that you're a threat to the bureaucracy. This is a huge issue. When you know too much, when you are sort of self-sufficient in knowledge, in, let's say, in my case, in academic department, you are a threat to the system. You're not going to permit the system, the bureaucracy, the media, to dictate your views to you. And therefore, you are going to be a serious critic, and thence a problem, and you need to be eliminated. You see this in music as well. Pop music in America right now is musically illiterate. And the simple fact is that in the music industry, a musician who is exceptionally talented is a threat. You know, a big owner of a record company cannot walk into a studio and demand that he play a certain way or that he spout a certain slogan. No, I am a professional musician. I play the way I play. So what really ends up happening is that all of these bureaucratic structures end up hiring and promoting mediocrity. Not incompetence, not supercompetence, someone who doesn't threaten them, someone who could do the job without threatening. And that's what Dostoevsky means by flunkyism. Somebody who has trained themselves to believe that the road to success is just imitating those with wealth and power. This is something particularly nasty and subversive within urban cultures and urban societies. He holds that the urban life is institutionalized hypocrisy for the same reasons that Tolstoy does, for the same reasons that Coolidge does. That the only thing that matters is a reputation for goodness, not actually goodness. So in other words, to use Platonic language, to be actually good but have the reputation of being wicked is far worse than having the reputation for good but actually being wicked. So it's only the external reality that matters in the urban world, in the capitalist world. And of course, you know, like all supporters of the peasant commune and the land and the agrarian world. And I consider myself, as well as many listeners of this program, to be a full-fledged agrarian in the same sense that Coolidge and Dostoevsky are. You know, the main accusation is that the cities exist parasitically on the land. Cities want cheap food. They want farmers to exist precisely at the level of poverty, so that they don't starve to death, but also that they don't get, you know, too uppity and start charging more money for all of their labors in the field. Therefore, the urban world exists as a parasite on nature. You know, in theological terms, you know, what does the word Cain mean? You know, Cain, who murdered Abel, he went on to found a city. It's this vicious, fratricidal world that is urbanism and the urban universe. The Jew is only at home in the city because there is no real identity. There is only the worship of carnality. There is this tremendous diversity where not one group can have enough power to challenge the power structure. Therefore, racial divisions and racial struggle is absolutely necessary. But this is something central to the urban mentality. That Dostoevsky looks at technology, and he sees technology, you know, in the Middle Ages. You know, the Middle Ages is actually very innovative in terms of its technological development. But the qualitative thing that, I live in Amish country here in southern Pennsylvania, and I speak to these people on a regular basis. There is a qualitative distinction between the Middle Ages, and by the way, the Amish are not medieval, they're actually post-Renaissance. They're heretics, there's no doubt about that, but socially speaking, they're worthy of emulation. And the claim of the Amish, the claim of the Old Believers, the claim of so many others, such as myself, Michael Hoffman, a lot of others who really look askance at technology, is that somewhere in the late 17th century, there is a qualitative shift. Technology ceases to be something that the average person needs to get a work job done, and it becomes instead the organizing principle of society serving elites and those with money. Two totally different things. It's not as if we have this single progression from the Roman Empire to 2009. No, we have a radical break. Really, the resurrection of alchemy in the late Renaissance, where technology ceases to be something pragmatic and simple to assist us in getting certain tasks done, something for the people, for the common folk, for the farmers. But technology becomes an organizing principle. It becomes a bureaucratizing principle, serving only the wealthy and the powerful. Technology doesn't seem to have a purpose except to make money, to continue to exploit the farmers and the countryside. And Dostoevsky, you know, he sees capitalist society claiming to be based on freedom and individualism and contract, and he sees the slavery of the factory, the slavery, what we would call the cubicle today. The cubicle world's infinitely worse than the serfdom that the revolutionaries so pompously condemned. The life of the serf in Russia, or even the serf in Norman England or anywhere else, was infinitely better than the life of the modern cubicle jockey or the slave in the factory who died at 45. The Industrial Revolution saw the plummeting of health, both moral and physical, as well as the plummeting of, longevity. During the Roman Empire, most of the Middle Ages, especially in Ireland and Ukraine and Russia, we had a very similar longevity. People lived to be about 70 if you factor out, infant mortality. It's right in the Old Testament, that right in the Psalms it says that the average span of life is 70 years. 20, 20, 20, 10. So 70 was roughly the ancient and medieval longevity, but when the Industrial Revolution hits, that plummets. That the bourgeoisie sees the slavery as freedom and calls it freedom, when in reality it's nothing more than prostitution. Slavery has simply been papered over with the slogans of progress and the slogans of statism and urbanism. And that modern religion, which Dostoevsky hates, I myself hate, is nothing more than the worship of Baal. It's nothing more than paganism for this reason. It's poison. reason is bankrupt because of the Industrial Revolution, because of atomic warfare, because of the genocide of the modern world. But modern religion is bankrupt because it's been nothing more than a lickspittle. And so what do we have? We have the world of Penteleimon Kulish. We have the village. We have the tradition. We have simplicity. We have the love of God, and we have the love of His Son, and that's all there is to it. So, God bless. I want to thank everyone for listening, my opponents as well as my friends. I want to change the political world that you live in, that I live in. Maybe one day my children can live there. If not, God help us. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.